And as the strains of Dixie continue behind us, let me introduce our three guests. They are all of them scholars of the Southern culture. And two of them are academic historians. The third is an historian who has been busy in Washington on the staff of the Cato Institute and now on the Heritage Foundation. That is James L. Swanson, who is the author of a very interesting new book titled Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase to Catch Lincoln's Killer. We took that as an occasion to talk about Southern culture and about the culture of and the politics of and the history of the Confederacy itself. And our other two guests are well-schooled in the history of the American South. Vernon Burton is professor of history and sociology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and Michael Perman is one of those odd Brits who is very interested in the American South. He is professor of history at the University of Illinois here in Chicago. It's always interesting to note the curious fact that the official tune of, or was it the official tune? It wasn't the anthem, but it was still the song identified with the South during the years of the Civil War, was of course written by a Northerner for a minstrel show.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the...
Yes, that's true.
Right,
yes.
Oh yes.
I don't know any details of it, but certainly it is odd that it's...
Dan something or other.
Dan Emmett.
Dan Emmett, yeah.
Okay. What's very interesting, too, is, of course, when Lincoln went to Richmond, he wanted Dixie played again.
Let the band play
our
Dixie.
Song.
That's right. Yeah.
Which is very... The other thing that sort of, to get at Confederate nationalism, can you imagine going off to fight and perhaps die singing Look Away versus the Battle Hymn of the Republic, stamping out the vintage, you know, for where people are dying for freedom? I think it says something about the Confederacy and American nationalism.
Well, continue that thought. What does it say?
Well, it's what is this? This song, Dixie, is written by a non-Southerner. It is a wistful look away, sort of, as many of the songs of the Confederacy are. I wish I was born. I wish I were there. This is not unique in any way. Something like the John Brown's Body, which Northern troops sang, and then Battle Hymn of the Republic, are talking about freedom, are talking about dying for righteous and justice and to set other people free as Christ did. So I think it does some hints to us about the soldiers and their sort of commitments and ways.
Yet when the secession first occurred, and in the years leading up and then the months leading up to the secession, surely the major politicians of the South, and maybe the people behind them, felt justified in their anger at the federal government and felt justified ultimately in separating themselves, didn't they?
Yes, they this had been, the contest had been going on for 30 years at least, and so the eventual secession was came at the end of a long series of threats and possibilities of secession, and a contest had been going on without resolution for a long, long while.
But how did they handle the difficult moral problem of seceding so as to preserve the institution of slavery?
Well,
when they also considered themselves good Christians.
They were also seceding to set up an independent republic and a separate country. And they could argue, and they did. In fact, they wore blue cockades in the streets in Charleston in 1860. They were the inheritors of the revolution of the American revolutionaries. And
so for them, the issue
America
was not,
seceded from the British Empire.
For them,
they're
the issue was not
from
slavery.
The American Empire.
It was the freedom of
It was
the freedom,
the freedom
of those
freedom
who held
to be
slave.
Able to have slavery.
Yeah.
I mean, the Southerners were, they owned slaves, but they were very, very aware that their own freedom was dependent upon having the slaves, and they would defend their having slaves as a mark of their freedom.
Let me add, Michael, too. One of the most interesting things is white Southerners' depiction of what they were doing is that they were saving the Union. I mean, that they thought the Constitution was being ruined. The Constitution was being warped by Northerners, and what they were doing, and you can look at how the Constitution is written, except for adding, you know, defense of slavery there and putting slavery in the Constitution, which was really, the word wasn't in the U.S. Constitution. It's very similar. It's almost identical in many ways down the line, but it was their idea that, as Michael says, they're preserving the revolutionary heritage, but also preserving what they think of as what the Union is supposed to be.
Right. There was an agreement made in 1787, and the North is breaking it.
Yeah.
And so they are, in fact, vindicated. They are holding true to the founding fathers.
The crucial part of that notions. Agreement, that is, first in the Articles of Confederation, then in the shaping of the Union and the writing of the Constitution, the crucial part, as far as the South saw it, was the delegation of all rights not otherwise specified, not otherwise reserved to the federal government. Those rights are verified for and guaranteed to the states themselves.
Right.
Exactly. They thought they were the true heirs of Washington, Jefferson, and Madison.
But did they really think that, or is that the cover story?
I think they believed it. I think they thought it was the Unionists who were perverting the Constitution, who were thwarting the original plan. They thought they were the patriots.
James Swanson, you come in on this with your new book, Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer, at the end of the war, obviously. The search for Booth and his co-conspirators. And the ultimate killing of Booth in a burning barn. But going back to the shaping of the Confederacy, what are your thoughts? I put this to all three of you, of course. What are your thoughts about the leading figures, the major historical actors? Who stands out, and are any of them so central that if they were not there, the Confederacy might not have pulled itself together?
Well, I think of two. I think of Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee. Of course, others were much more significant in the move to secession, especially leaders in South Carolina and some of the other first states to leave the Union. But Jefferson Davis had, the toughest job in the Confederacy. How do you centralize and hold the government together to fight the Union when your argument for secession is separatism and states' rights? Jefferson Davis had a deal with states that didn't want to send troops from Georgia to North Carolina because those troops were supposed to be saved to defend Georgia. Other states didn't want to send uniforms to another state because they were for their own state. Jefferson Davis had an incredible dilemma of how could he centralize the Confederate effort to fight a war when the very purpose of secession was to decentralize from the federal government.
Who was Jefferson Davis in his prior history in the United States?
A very successful politician, a superb Secretary of War under Buchanan, and had a fine military record in the Mexican War. He was West Point trained, and he actually was a wonderful choice for the Confederacy. He came from the Deep South from Mississippi. He had a record in national politics and experience. He was not.
Had he been a senator as well?
Yes, that's right. Sure. Yes, right.
So he had a long career in the American government.
I mean, he was tested. And Yancey said, the man and the hour have come. Mm-hmm. And he was just perfect.
One of the great ironies is that, as Michael said, as Secretary of War, some attribute that he built the modern Union Army that defeated the Confederacy. A lot of it was attributed to his skill as Secretary of War to build up a modern.
If he was the man of the hour, the man that was required, is he in a way parallel to the man of the hour, the man who held together the nation when it was first born? Is he, in a way, similar to George Washington?
Yes.
Except that his nation fails.
Yes, right. But he's heading a new nation, same way Washington did. And one of the things that's very interesting about the Confederacy, you just asked about whether the Confederates felt that they were, upholding the values and the traditions of the founding fathers. Jefferson Davis was inaugurated twice, first as provisional president, and then as permanent president. The first one, he went to the Capitol in Montgomery with six white horses drawing his carriage, just as Washington did, on February the 22nd. was the date that he chose.
That's Washington's birthday.
And then when he was inaugurated the next time, which was in Richmond, he stood just by the statue of Washington in the Capitol at Richmond, and it was very clear, again, that the parallel was being
sought. It has been suggested that it was rather perverse for them to establish the Capitol, the second Capitol, in Richmond, just a short distance from Washington. That doesn't seem strategically wise, but was it symbolically intended?
I think they had to have Virginia. I think the importance of Virginia to the Confederacy, and it probably would not have been a Confederacy if Virginia hadn't gone or lasted very long. No. I do have a quote I want to put in before we move from this point, though, because it's a sort of an honor of Michael and relates to Jefferson Davis. In 1862, William Gladstone remarked, and this is a quotation, "We may have our own opinions about slavery. We may be for or against the South, but there's no doubt that Jefferson Davis and other leaders of the South have made an army. They are making it, it appears, a navy, and they have made what is more than either, they have made a nation." And of course, that's William Gladstone in England speaking toward what Jefferson Davis had
accomplished. Well, clearly they did make a nation, and they lasted for 4 years of very, very arduous and difficult time, and they lost some over 300,000 men in battle, I believe.
Right.
How did they weld that nation? What explains not the secession, but rather the ability to pull together and forge a nation which fought diligently in a war in which they were essentially doomed?
Well, I think a few reasons. First, I think they were better prepared militarily at the outset. Yes, the Union had more railroad tracks, had more men, had more factories, had more weaponry, but the South had a more pervasive pre-war military culture. First, our top officers from West Point who had fought in the Mexican War included many of the top generals who went over to the Confederacy. They had better leadership at the top.
Including Robert E. Lee, I
believe. Yes, at the beginning of the war. They had Lee, they had Stonewall Jackson. They had others who were just terrific leaders. And also this, the South was in this state of militancy from the 1840s through the 1850s. In fact, there's a wonderful book called The Militant South, written by John Hope Franklin, the great historian. And he describes how the South built this pre-war paramilitary culture, as though they were waiting for the day. Planning for secession, planning for violence.
Isn't it curious that in a way you might say that the South still is sort of paramilitary? It's still more committed to military life, I think, than the rest of the country.
Well, I think it reflects back to slavery. Whatever the myths are, the only way people did not want to be slaves, there had to be violence or the threat of violence there all the time to make people to be slaves. So it grew up with a sort of violent culture, which can be translated into paramilitary. And of course, the reason there was a military there was the patrols and things to make sure that people stayed slaves, and symbolically. So it does go back to slavery in terms of explaining. There is an irony, I think, about Robert E. Lee, because of course, at first he was called Granny Lee, Spades Lee for digging and not being aggressive. But one of the great ironies for me with Robert E. Lee is, here is a general who, at least most historians believe, was not really committed to slavery, was offered the command of the Union Army, went with Virginia. And then, though, if Lee had not been so successful, my own guess is that the South would have, in fact, surrendered much quicker, would have come back in, and slavery might actually have been preserved and part of the deal. But Lee made that war last so long by his skillful fighting that in the end, when the time comes, Emancipation Proclamation is part of it, and the end of slavery.
When one talks about the war, one goes inevitably to the battlefield and analyzes the great victories, the great battles, the great strategies, usually with an eye to Union strategy, because you want to account for the victor and how he became victorious. But tonight we'll look at the war itself, right after we pause for some commercials, from the point of view of the situation that faced the Southern military, Lee and Stonewall Jackson and the various others, and for that matter the Secretary of War and Jefferson Davis, who had a strong hand in designing the strategy itself. So, how they fought the war from the South, as we continue with James Swanson, Vernon Burton, and Michael Perman.
We are a band of brothers and native to the soil, fighting for the property we gained by honest toil. And when our rights were threatened, the cry rose near and far,
Hurrah for the bonnie blue flag that bears a single star. Hurrah, hurrah for Southern rights, hurrah. Hurrah for the bonnie blue flag that bears a single star. First gallant South Carolina nobly made the stand. Then came Alabama and took her by the hand. Next quickly Mississippi, Georgia and Florida, all raised on high the bunny blue flag that bears a single star.
Hurrah!
Hurrah! Hurrah! For Southern rights, hurrah! Hurrah! For the bunny blue flag that bears a single star.
How popular was that song? Is that a marching song from the war itself?
It is in the time period. Again, though, I think when you hear what it says, we're fighting for our property versus fighting for liberty and to set men free.
It says we're fighting for Southern rights. That's the actual phrase used.
And property.
And property. Lesser cause.
Yeah, well, it's sort of, you wonder, do you really want to charge a hill for property?
Yeah. It's not as noble as what the Union said it was fighting for. I quite agree.
But the South thought that the American Revolution was a property rights revolution, mm-hmm. to defend property rights against British incursions. And once upon a time, American patriots believed that all rights were equal, property rights, civil rights, the right to speech, the right to be free of excessive British taxation. So the Southerners didn't view the property rights claim as fringe or secondary. They viewed property rights as the equivalent of liberty.
They're borrowing from the English utilitarians, in a way. It's Adam Smith is as much a patron saint for them, I should think, as...
True.
Even if they're all equal, do you want to die for property versus liberty and set men free?
I don't want to die for anything.
That's right.
But young men are ready to die if you can fire them up enough for what they take to be a noble cause. And something that allows them to release their animal spirits, their strong, aggressive impulses, which go with heavy loads of testosterone.
I think
that's how war works.
Well, I think it really was a different romantic age, too, and we forget that. It really was a romantic age, and people thought in these terms, and even their thoughts of death, I think, changed because of the Civil War. I mean, I think what death meant and people still being with you in some ways really shifts with the Civil War and American consciousness.
By the way, in the song we just heard, the Bonnie Blue Flag, the Stars and Bars, where did that flag come from? What's the heraldry of it all?
I don't know, George. The single star is the flag of Texas. I don't know if the Bonnie Blue Flag was written by a Texan, though. But you're right about these songs galvanizing people. At the launch party for my book, we had one of the best Civil War bands in the country play a lot of these songs, Northern and Southern songs. And this was in Washington, D.C., and you should have seen how people's spines stiffen. And they snapped to attention when they heard these songs 140, 145 years later. People loved the songs.
Now, how did the South pull itself together to wage a war? Were they ready for an extended confrontation?
No, I don't think they were. There were a few arsenals in the South, and they did have a lot of old weapons left over from the War of 1812 and the Mexican War. The best thing they had was territory, their agriculture, and their top leadership, and the martial spirit of the men who had joined the Confederate Army. They really had to start from scratch. They didn't have cannons. They didn't have major cannon foundries. They had to build a lot of that and manufacture a lot of the weaponry or import it from England.
And they didn't have a government, and they didn't have an army.
Well, how soon did they get into the field and begin military operations?
Well, they had to form a government first, and they did that even before everybody had seceded. That began in early part of 61, before Virginia and North Carolina go. So, and
how does Davis become president? It's not a general election through the South, is it?
I'm sorry?
How does Davis become president?
Oh, he's chosen by the Confederate Congress.
The Confederate Congress is the
linchpin for the setting up the new government. It's a legislature, it's an electoral college, and it's a constitutional convention because it also produces a constitution. So it's all, and those people are actually sent by their states, so they are official
delegates. And it's pretty remarkable if you think about it, Michael. They sit down and write a constitution before they do anything else. That's the importance, I think, of a constitution and the importance of thinking of themselves in terms of the U.S. Constitution and that this is what makes a nation. Yeah. It's different than almost any other country. I think the United States and the Confederacy being a part of it, that a constitution actually makes a country, usually.
James Swanson, one of our guests, and author of the book Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase to Catch Lincoln's Killer, of which we will talk at the appropriate time when we arrive there. But, James, you were once the editor of the Cato Institute Supreme Court Review.
Yes.
So you must know a good deal about constitutions. Our Supreme Court is concerned with and bases everything it does, supposedly, upon the Constitution. What was the Confederate Constitution like?
Well, in many ways, it was similar to the federal Constitution. They refined it, narrowed it, and certainly they focused on the property rights. I consider that the biggest difference between the two. They were consciously trying to mimic the federal Constitution, mm-hmm. but improve it and make it better. And, of course, make sure that the states had more rights than the Union was willing to give them.
But there were a lot of things that were different. I think that the assertion that it's just simply the same thing with Confederate States of America written in instead is not right. They kept the basic framework, but they laid a lot of changes. Jefferson Davis's term is a non-renewable 6 years term. The presidency is much stronger in the Confederacy than it was in the Union, purposely. They move power from the Congress to the president. There are lots of provisions in the Constitution for ending some of the powers of Congress which led to the sort of patronage and the spoil system and the building up of political parties. And for example, Jefferson Davis can't touch sub-cabinet appointees. That's where most of the presidential patronage comes from. And protective tariff, internal improvements, those are both not within Congress's power. And so there are, you know, they are in fact trying to create a constitution without political parties. And in fact, there aren't any political parties in the Confederacy.
Ever?
None.
Through the 4 years?
Yeah.
But there's a Jefferson Davis faction and an anti-Jefferson Davis faction.
Well, but the anti-faction is never organized. It becomes very shrill and personal, but that partly is because there is no organization of it to moderate that. Mm-hmm. And there's a study of voting behavior in the Confederate Congress, and there are about two people who at any one time are in a consistent way opposed to Jefferson Davis. Jefferson Davis gets what he wants from the Confederate Congress.
So there's solidarity at the elite levels, basically.
Well, I think solidarity because you don't question the admission, which is to have independence, and you don't mm-hmm. actually have mechanisms for organizing opposition.
Doris Kearns Goodwin has recently published a book about Lincoln's cabinet. Yeah. What about Davis's cabinet? What about the other leading figures of the Confederacy? One I'm inevitably interested in is the major Jewish figure in that whole operation. He held about three different cabinet posts, Judah Benjamin.
And the brains of the Confederacy.
Was he really the brains?
Well, I think he certainly had the brains, and even his latter career afterwards shows just how brilliant he probably was.
When he winds up in England after the war.
He rebuilds completely from nothing to a major in a different legal system.
He was Secretary of the Treasury, I think, Secretary of War.
Treasury first, but then war mainly.
Also Secretary of State at some point, was he not?
And was he Secretary of State too? Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, but I think war was the main one after Seddon.
So was he then one of the main strategists of the war as well?
Well, I think so. I don't know exactly whether one would say that he was a creative, imaginative force. I mean, he was probably workmanlike and got the job done. But I don't think anybody has said that he was a real military strategist, and that probably was not what the job involved.
But getting the job done was so important. That's one thing that Lincoln and Jefferson Davis have in common. They had highly effective secretaries of war. Lincoln quickly dispatched his first Secretary of War, Simon Cameron, to be minister to Russia. He was ineffective. He allowed corruption to take place. The troops were being given shoddy uniforms, imported rifles that wouldn't fire, and he replaced him with Edwin M. Stanton, a lawyer and once a rival of Lincoln's. But Lincoln never let a man's high opinion of himself prevent Lincoln from using him for a good purpose. And Lincoln said of Stanton that Stanton was the rock upon which the waves of the rebellion crashed mm-hmm. and were broken. And Lincoln himself said he couldn't have survived or won the war without Stanton at his side. And Jefferson Davis was fortunate to have a very efficient, very intelligent Secretary of War. Neither side could have fought the way it did without having someone know how to build the army, equip the army, and do all the little things that in aggregate made those armies effective fighting forces.
But you needed a leader, whether it was Davis or someone else, who could also have transformative influence upon ordinary folk, who could stir up passions of patriotism and hold them to an increasingly difficult and arduous task across the distance of those full 4 years. Who did that for the Confederacy?
I'm not so sure whether it was Davis, actually.
I'm not sure it was Davis.
Davis actually is he's not a great orator, and while he's very experienced and knowledgeable, that may have been his undoing in a sense. He really wanted to be out in the battlefield, I think, and he went out, in fact, during the Peninsula campaign to sort of be with the army, mm-hmm. as a good commander-in-chief should be, actually a good commander-in-chief shouldn't probably do that, actually, but he wanted to be out there on his horse with the men. And he tended to be, I think, concerned about details and rather limited in that sense once he actually had the power to run a whole government.
The Confederacy was not Nazi Germany, but who's the Dr. Goebbels figure? Is there any? A minister of propaganda, in essence?
I want to go back to the question of who it was. See, I think one of the ironies and what explains Confederate nationalism is who stirs up the patriotism are the soldiers themselves, and then the heroes like Robert E. Lee, yes. Stonewall Jackson. And then that's one of the problems about basing your nationalism on your leaders. What happens when Stonewall Jackson is killed?
Mm-hmm.
But I actually think this is what we, and you see it even today, the celebration of the noble Confederate soldier. Not that the Union soldiers and generals weren't celebrated, but not in the sense of a Robert E. Lee or a Stonewall Jackson or a Jeb Stuart. I mean, they become almost, even in that day and time, not just later, but almost more than patriots, they become sort of heroic figures representing extraordinary values. Again and again, this sort of Christian, in parentheses, values that they sort of celebrate themselves for in the Confederacy were ennobled.
This is the moment to give you another song from the southern side of the Civil War, the one titled The Rebel Soldier. What do we learn from this? We'll get it on in just a moment. I'm surprising the people in the booth by calling for it, but it is coming.
Cause me to mourn.
Well, it's rather mournful, that song. It's hardly one that stirs patriotic fervor.
But it's very defiant, though, isn't it? It's very...
It is.
Saying, I'll eat when I eat, and I'll drink when I drink, and I'll die
and
when
I'll live
I die.
Till I die. Yes.
Well, I think the mournful tone also reminds us there were a lot of Scots and Irish in the Confederacy.
Ah.
I mean, this reminds me of a mournful Irish ballad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it sounds war-weary at the same time. I don't know what the history of that song is exactly. It may have been towards the end of the war that it was first written or first sung.
Yeah. A lot of the northern songs are sort of rather different. They are all about young men and their mothers, before the battle, mother, and very sort of not at all older people who are world-weary or defiant, but people who just want to be comforted and they're feeling badly being away from home. That's one kind of Union song. There are others of too. But.
One kind of Confederate song that I don't think there were many of were Jefferson Davis worship songs. I think that Davis never won the first love of the Confederacy. That belonged to Lee, to Stonewall, and to the others. He was respected intellectually and admired, but he was not beloved, and he didn't inspire that passion that the other leaders did. He was viewed as somehow remote and removed, and after his suffering at the end of the war, he became more liked by the South, I think, than during the war, because he was viewed as a almost Christ-like figure who was punished.
Whereas, on the other side, was Lincoln really Father Abraham in the sentiments of the Northern population or the Northern Army?
Well, was he not as popular as he subsequently became too. He was defeated for re-election and so on. But I think with the Emancipation Proclamation and some other things that he did, I think he did capture an affection. But
we have the song, "We Are Coming, Father Abraham, 100,000 strong."
Yeah.
That suggests that he was somehow a majestic figure for the war.
I think what Michael said earlier about political parties plays in here. You had an opposition party, and so it was very hard. I think it became created during the war, and particularly during the end, but it was very divided. As you said, he didn't lose, but at re-election, he thought he was going to lose.
Yes. He even signed a paper that he thought he was going to lose.
We are, gentlemen, terribly late for commercials. I'm too involved in this. But we pause right now for some quick messages, and then we return to Vernon Burton, professor of history and sociology at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, Michael Perman, professor of history, University of Illinois Chicago, James L. Swanson, author of the new book, Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase to Catch Lincoln's Killer. And we return after this. Back to our team of historians, Michael Perman, Vernon Burton, and James Swanson, historians, all of them interested in the South, the culture of the South, the polity of the South, that is of the Confederacy, and to be sure, the waging of the Civil War and the aftermath of that Civil War. You remember the Duke of Wellington asked about the Battle of Waterloo and how the forces that he led managed to win it, got off a great line. He says, "It was a damned close-run thing." Meaning it could have gone the other way. Was the Civil War a damn close-run thing? Are there contingencies which, if the values are somewhat altered, might have produced a victory for the Confederacy?
I think the Confederacy's best chance was in the first year or two of the war. Nobody was ready in 1861 to deliver the knockout blow and suffer as many casualties as it would take and spend as much money as it would take and use as much manpower. If either side had committed to all-out total war, let's say Bull Run or Manassas in July 1861, the Confederates could have swept into Washington and driven the government out. And early in the war, the symbolism of the capital cities was much more important than it became later. Early in the war, the Union motto was "On to Richmond," as though capturing this city 90 miles away would end the war. But neither side knew what the price they'd be willing to pay later. And if either side at the beginning of the war had been willing to pay that price at the beginning, I think they could have swept the field. If the Confederates were as willing to fight as they were and sacrifice as much as they were at Gettysburg, at the Wilderness, at other places, they might have delivered the knockout punch in the first year of the war, but they couldn't muster the psychological iron will to incur those losses and make that fight. Partly, they needed to prepare their army. But I think early in the war, either side might have won a quick victory if they had made an all-out commitment.
Against that is the judgment which you get from many military historians, that the South was doomed from the very beginning, that the North had far greater resources in terms of men who could be mobilized and, of course, material that could be employed to pursue, to fight the war, and that inevitably force predominates over anything else, and it was the Union's war to win, and the South was fated to lose, but for some miraculous turn which did not occur.
Well, I actually think that's probably what did happen, but it didn't have to. Remember, all the South had to do was not lose. It didn't have to go on the offensive. But one of the, and you don't go on the offensive if you have fewer men, fewer resources. But you count up the battles, and it is the Confederacy which is on the offensive most of the time, taking the greater losses. It's part of, I think, the very culture of the South itself that goes back. We spoke earlier about violence and other things. But I don't think that it, I think because we know what happened, we think that's the way it has to be, but I don't think so at all. And I'm convinced if it had not been Lincoln as president, almost any other person probably would have either let the South go on, or certainly wouldn't have taken the incredible hit that the North took from the South. I think we have to look to Lincoln and Lincoln's leadership and his commitment to the Union and this war to understand why the North stayed there. We've always looked to the South to see why defeat. I think you need to look to the North to see why the North won.
That's right, because the Confederacy didn't have to invade New York City, capture Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and go to Chicago. They just had to keep the Union out. But the Union had to get in and get down there. And if the Confederates didn't win early with a knockout blow, if they could also just survive long enough to tire the Northern people. And if they killed enough Union soldiers and prolonged the war long enough, they also had the option of trying to force a political solution with the Union. If they just held their defensive perimeter, kept the Union out, they might have worn out the Northern.
So you're suggesting, really, all three of you seem to be agreeing. Well, I'm not sure that Michael agrees on this because he hasn't spoken to it yet. But you seem to be suggesting that the South used the wrong strategy.
Well, no, basically the strategy was a defensive one, but you can't defend, once the Union has come into the South, you have to push them back, so you have to move forward there. But the South never, I think, really wanted to, you know, as James said, you know, they could have delivered a knockout punch, but it was not on, on their radar screen to go to Washington. They were just trying to keep the Northerners out. When they did go north, it was not in order to conquer territory or seize Washington. It was just to show that they could, in fact, do that and get across into the north. And every time, each time they did it twice, two crucial battles occurred each time, decisive battles, I think.
Which ones are you referring?
Antietam and Gettysburg. Each time, all it was going into the north and then leaving. They weren't going to stay there and forage and camp and, you know, dig a trench and entrench and so on, or even go off to
float like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
Well, it actually had a it was more, I think, a psychological thing that you can't win a war. I think this is how Davis and Lee calculated. You can't win a war by just being defensive, because people will say, well, when have you won something? You know, all you're doing is doing nothing and just sort of keeping them back. We want a spectacular victory. And there was a sort of, you know, there was a sort of, we've got to give them a victory. So there was a lot of a sense that if you move forward, have some victories, then that keeps people happy. And if you go into the North, that makes them even more happy. Well, we're actually, you know, really
taking defensive. And that's the military career in the war of Robert E. Lee, is it not?
Yes.
Would the South have been better off if Lee had not commanded the Army of Northern Virginia?
Oh, no. I mean, they would have found... Well, they would have been better off.
Lee was terrific general. People still study Lee strategies, and given the few sources and he had even at the end, the big question is, I think, you know, why did Lee surrender or just not tell his men to go home and continue fighting? I think that tells us a lot about what's going on. He didn't have to. He didn't have to tell his men, let's go home, we're surrendering. He could have just said, let's ride away.
You remind me suddenly of that wonderful bit of counter-history written by James Thurber years ago, titled, If Grant Had Been Drinking at Appomattox, Where Grant, Misunderstanding the Situation, Surrenders to Lee.
Well, there has been some revisionism on Lee. Some of the books have caused quite an eruption in Civil War studies, especially by Lee's defenders. A lot of people, even some of Lee's defenders, might have wanted to relieve him before the third day of Gettysburg began. That catastrophic charge, that's the big question mark. Pickett's charge on the third day, sending those men across that mile of open field under cannon fire and musket fire, that's always the big question mark in the career of Lee.
There's a new book, though, that even suggests that in fact, Lee's plan wasn't completed, where he had supposedly Jeb Stuart riding to the back of Pickett's charge, and if this guy named Custer hadn't interfered, and if Jeb Stuart had followed his orders and gone forward instead of going off to fight Custer, who held him there, and it hit at the back of the line at the same time as Pickett was charging, you'd have had a different result in what Lee was willing to sacrifice to go. So it continues to be a debate with Lee.
There's the wonderful counter-historical novel written by McKinley Cantor years ago. I wonder if any of you know it. I think it's titled Bring the Jubilee. And where it is its counter-historical premise is that Pickett's charge works out opposite from the way it really did. And that leads to Confederate victory and to a separate Confederacy, which is now acknowledged by the Union. And he gives you the history of that nation, or those two nations, neighboring one another, for the following 70 or 80 years before they reunite.
What it leaves out is Lincoln would have never surrendered. He would have been, in fact, voted out. But Lincoln would never have surrendered.
Gentlemen, we are due for another batch of commercials and a quick newscast, and we shall directly return after that.
Stack arms, men, pile on the rail, stir up the campfire bright. No matter if the canteen fails, we'll make a roaring night. Here Shenandoah brawls along, here Burly Blue Ridge echoes strong, to swell the brigade's rousing song of Stonewall Jackson's way. Here Shenandoah brawls along, here Burly Blue Ridge echoes strong, to swell the brigade's rousing song of Stonewall Jackson's way.
The second figure in the military pantheon of the Confederacy, Stonewall Jackson, who was shot down when?
Chancellorsville.
And in what year?
Yes, in a fog.
1863.
In a fog.
Yeah.
Clausewitz's fog of war is really operative at that moment, is it not?
Right.
If Stonewall Jackson had not been shot down, would the war have turned out differently?
I'm
always fascinated in the role of particular individual historical actors in the turns that history takes.
I think if Lee had Jackson at Gettysburg, the Confederates might have won Gettysburg.
There you are, really.
He was the general that Lee really trusted the most. In fact, when his arm was amputated after he was shot by his own men at Chancellorsville, when Lee heard of the wound and of the amputation, he said, "Jackson has lost his left arm, but I've lost my right." I think only Jackson might have been able to change the tactics at Gettysburg or persuade Lee to do another end run rather than the frontal assault. There would have been a chance. I'm not saying that he would have necessarily turned the tide, but I think the Confederates might have had a chance to win Gettysburg.
It's more than that, though. He was so mythical that his Union troops were terrified. I mean, he seemed invincible. And I think Lee felt invincible with him. He could do anything. I mean, these marches people still study is amazing. How quickly territory covered, forces twice his size are routed. I mean, so I think there's also that mythology without Stonewall Jackson, but troops were afraid of Jackson, and he was fearless.
But the war came to an end, and we know how it worked out. And we focus in now on another crucial chapter, a chapter which transformed the nation's lasting image of Abraham Lincoln, namely his martyr's death. And we zero in not on Lincoln. In fact, we just talked about Lincoln for the full 2 hours with Richard Carwardine, a fine historian, an Englishman, who's done a major new book, Lincoln, A Life of Purpose and Power. We did that about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and that conversation is on our audio archive right now for anyone who wants to hear that two-hour program. But we zero in instead on an actor, of all things, an actor from a great acting family, the equivalent of the Barrymores of that time.
Yes, John Wilkes Booth, one of the great stars of his age.
Even more so than his brother Edwin?
Well, not in the North. Edwin prospered more in the North. He was a unionist. He was a pro-Lincoln man. John Wilkes Booth gravitated towards the South. He was raised in Bel Air, Maryland, enjoyed his greatest successes in New Orleans, in Richmond, in other southern cities.
What sort of acting did he do? What kinds of roles did he play?
Mostly Shakespeare. He was known for his great passion, his athleticism, his swordsmanship, his skill with a knife. Some even nicknamed him, with some derision, the gymnastic actor, because he loved to bound from heights on the stage and leap from place to place on the stage.
He did that at Ford's Theater as well, did he not?
Yes, he did. He
broke his leg.
Yes. his leaping ability was a part of his escape plan. He had decided to kill Lincoln that day. He had been stalking him and thinking about it. He'd given up on his kidnapping plan. In late 1864 and early 65, Booth wanted to turn the course of the war by kidnapping Lincoln in Washington.
What had his career been, apart from his theatrical career, up until that fateful day? He hadn't been in arms, had he?
No. In fact, when he was criticized for that, he wrote a secret political manifesto that was later found in the vault of his sister's home in Philadelphia. Booth said the reason he didn't join the Confederate Army was because his access across the lines, because of his fame, his wealth, his charismatic power over others. He said that he was worth much more to the South as an operative, an agent, and man of secrets and plots than as simply a mere private who might be killed by the first Union.
Did he
Union
do
Valley.
Significant intelligence work for the South before the assassination?
No, he didn't, but he got involved with people who did. One of his key co-conspirators was a man named John Surratt, Jr., who was a Confederate courier and agent who would often make the run from Richmond to New York City to Montreal, Canada, a hotbed of Confederate Secret Service activity. And then Booth fell into a network. He went to Montreal, met Confederate agents. They gave him the names of people along the route to Richmond who would help him with the kidnapping plot. And, of course, he still had their names when he decided to kill the president. And so he wasn't running off willy-nilly. He knew the route he would take after he would shoot Lincoln at Ford's Theater.
It's amazing how easily he got through to the box in which the Lincolns were sitting. Was there no Secret Service protecting the president in those days?
No. It's incredible to think of that. Lincoln's security was almost non-existent. It's a miracle that during the 4 years of the Civil War, a Confederate agent didn't stroll into the White House and just shoot him at his desk. If we wanted to see Lincoln, we could walk through the White House doors, tell one of his two or three male secretaries, I want to talk to the president. You would often be told, sit on that bench. He's busy now, but he'll see you later. What's your business? When Lincoln rode around in his carriage in Washington, he might either be alone, just with his coachman, or he might have 2, 4, maybe 6 cavalrymen, but only sometimes. And he went to Ford's Theater, all in the carriage, were the coachman, his personal valet, Mary Lincoln, and their two guests in the box. There was a fellow named Forbes, who was kind of a White House policeman, more devoted to protecting the White House from vandalism or theft during parties. But he was not a Secret Service guard or an official guard of the president. And one man stood between Booth and Lincoln at Ford's Theater that night, his valet Charles Forbes. And Booth presented him with a piece of paper. No one knows what it is. Witnesses saw it. It was probably a calling card. No one would stop one of the most recognizable, celebrated actors from going in and paying his respects on the president. It was easy. It was so easy. It really was more a matter of will than plotting to get to the president.
Incredible, by modern standards, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
Why did he have such a strange crew of people? I mean, there's a famous actor who's been thinking about this for a while, yet the people he works with, they're a very marginal group. There's nobody of any distinction or any merit at all.
It's a mixed lot. These people worship Booth. They were Booth followers more than they were fanatical Confederates. One was a young 22-year-old Washington man named David Harold, who was a druggist assistant. He didn't care about Lincoln or the Confederacy, but he loved being in Booth's shadow. And he loved being with the star, and he would do what Booth told him. Another was a strange German immigrant, George Atzerodt, who was charged by Booth to murder the vice president, Andrew Johnson, at the same time that Booth was killing Lincoln. Booth's most dangerous co-conspirator, though, was a very powerful, very loyal, very brave ex-Confederate soldier named Lewis Powell, who had fought at Gettysburg, been captured, was paroled, and then joined Mosby's Rangers, a legendary Confederate cavalry group. And he was brought into Booth's circle. And his mission the night of April 14th, 1865, Good Friday, was to murder the Secretary of State at home in his bed while Booth was killing Lincoln and Atzerodt was killing the vice president.
The only one of those plots that succeeded was, of course, to shoot Lincoln down.
Yes, the Atzerodt got drunk and got afraid and never called on the vice president's hotel room, where, of course, he was unguarded. The plot was simply to knock on the door, have Johnson answer the door and shoot him to death on the spot or stab him to death. But he was spared that night due to the cowardice of Booth's accomplice. But the Secretary of State barely lived through the night. Lewis Powell did invade his home, found him in bed, broke into the bedroom, did battle with two of Seward's sons, with his young daughter, with a brave army nurse who was stabbed multiple times defending Seward. He was cut viciously in the face and in the throat, and he almost bled to death. His doctor said, upon his arrival at the house, that the Secretary of State looked like an exsanguinated corpse. But he whispered, "I am not dead." Some of the police, some of the doctors closed the house. He came within a hair's breadth of bleeding to death, but he survived that night.
Did Booth really shout "Sic Semper Tyrannis" as he jumped from the balcony, from the box to the stage?
He did. After he shot Lincoln in the box, and Lincoln's guest, Major Rathbone, tried to stop Booth, and he was stabbed, Booth shouted, "Freedom." Then he jumped to the stage, and he wanted to escape. It wasn't a suicide mission, but he also wanted to enjoy the fame and the glory, so he couldn't resist facing the audience of 1,500 people, waving his bloody dagger in the air and shouting, "Sic Semper Tyrannis," which, of course, is the state motto of Virginia, thus always to tyrants. And then he also shouted, "The South is avenged." But one of the most telling things, I think he said, was something that hardly anyone in the audience heard. He said it as he was rushing off the stage, and it was heard by a few people sitting close to the stage. And this was really more of an exaltation to himself. Just before he vanished, he said, "I have done it." And then he escaped out the back door of the theater and got on his horse.
How did
and galloped
he get away?
Well, he rode ahead of the news. No one in the audience knew what to do. They didn't realize what had happened. They thought maybe it was part of the play, a stunt for the president's
The play
visit.
Was a comedy, Our American Cousin,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes. And he rushed past the actors. Only when Major Rathbone yelled, "Stop that man. Will no one stop that man?" And then Clara Harris shouted, "He shot the president." One man sitting in the front row stood up, leaped across the orchestra, and pursued Booth. But by the time that man got in the alley, Booth was already on his horse and kicked the horse and rode away. He rode ahead of the news. He galloped through Washington, across the U.S. Capitol grounds, and then went to down Pennsylvania Avenue, and then turned down 11th Street and headed to the Navy Yard Bridge, really the first danger point, because that bridge was closed after 9 o'clock at night, wartime security. And there were Union troops guarding that bridge. And Booth had to figure out a way to talk his way past them and ride across that bridge and get into Maryland.
Was all of this with a broken ankle or a broken leg?
Well, yeah, a broken bone about 2 inches above the ankle. It was a fracture, not a major break. The bone didn't snap. It didn't penetrate his flesh. Mm. His adrenaline was rushing through his body in such quantities. I'm not sure he really felt much when he landed on stage. He was able to still move, to walk, and get on the horse. The injury plagued him more later, but it didn't stop his escape from the theater.
And your new book, Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer, tells the story of how he was pursued and how he got away for those 12 days, though ultimately they kill him.
Well, that's the missing part of the story. I think every school child knows that Lincoln was shot by Booth, the famous actor, and somehow Booth was taken in the end. So what I tried to do is write a book about that middle period, that less-known period of the 12 days when Booth was on the run. Essentially, it's the story of one man on a horse trying to escape from several thousand detectives, gunboats, soldiers, officers. And it's really an incredible story that combines luck, brilliance, and guts. Booth met Confederate soldiers along the way, Confederate sympathizers, slave owners, former slaves, Confederate women, secret agents. Some of them helped him. Others refused because they were afraid, and Booth condemned them in this incredible journal he kept during his escape. He had a couple hours head start into Maryland because the Union didn't know what to do. The Secretary of War rushed to the Peterson house where Lincoln was taken after he was shot, and while Lincoln was dying in the back bedroom, Secretary of War Stanton questioned the first witnesses, organized the hunt, sent out the first telegrams to military commanders around the nation that the president had been shot. And by then, Booth was 12 miles south of Washington, picking up a rifle, getting some whiskey, and going on to that notorious doctor, Samuel Mudd, to get treatment for the leg.
Did Mudd know who he was and what had happened?
Yes. One of the great myths in American history is that Dr. Mudd knew nothing.
Yes.
That he was just an innocent country physician obeying his Hippocratic oath. In fact, he had met Booth on several prior occasions. Booth had come down to his house and spent the night. Mudd helped Booth buy a horse in the region. They met in Washington and met secretly in a hotel room. And, of course, the Confederate agents in Montreal had given Mudd's name to Booth. Later, after it was all over, Mudd confessed to a fellow Confederate, "I knew all along it was him from the moment he walked in my door."
There's a particular figure in this manhunt who's the crucial pursuer, and he's going to be played by a famous actor. This book has already been sold for film rights, I gather.
Yes, it's going to be produced by Walden Media, which has the Chronicles of Narnia film mm-hmm. that's out in theaters now. And Harrison Ford is going to play one of the detectives in pursuit of Booth, and one of the detectives who played a crucial role in on the last 12
days. Who is he? What's his name?
Colonel Everton Conger. And mm-hmm. he was one of the three commanders of the cavalry patrol that finally trapped Booth 12 days later. Booth was essentially lost to the nation for almost the 12 days. No one knew where he was. People searched for him in Philadelphia. There were rumors that he was hiding in a cellar in Washington in a wine cask, that he was dressed as a woman or a freed slave wandering the streets of Washington in makeup or blackface, that he was on a train in Philadelphia greeting people by using his name. And for a week he vanished when a Confederate agent hit him in a pine thicket near the Potomac waiting to send him across. But in the end, a report came that Booth had been sighted near Port Royal, Virginia. Union cavalry rushed aboard a steamboat, and in a day and a half they made up all that ground that Booth had struggled for 12 days to make. And in the middle of the night on April 26, 1865, they surrounded the tobacco barn where Booth and his fellow conspirator David Harold were hiding, and that led to the whole climax of the hunt.
Indulging myself once again in historical contingency and what-ifs, counterfactuals, what if Booth had missed? Took the shot but missed.
Oh, well, the Reconstruction period would have been very different. Andrew Johnson became president and did not have the Lincolnian political savvy, and we know what happened. He simply confronted the Republican Party and blocked the way to produce policies and terms for the South. But Lincoln, on the other hand, was very adept, very flexible, but at the same time a man who knew what he wanted. And I think he would have avoided that confrontation. There would have never have been an impeachment of Lincoln, for example, in 1868. I don't know that one could say he would have succeeded, whatever that might mean, but it certainly would not have been so obstructionist and so pointless a struggle with.
So you think there would have been truly a more effective period of Reconstruction?
Well, I'm a great Lincoln fan. I guess he truly is
that
my hero. So I have a. Yes, I think so. I think it would have been a very interesting period. Of course, we're, you know, historians. We're sort of playing profit here. We'd make a lot more money as opposed to what did happen. But I think Lincoln had that rare capacity of a leader to grow, and you can see him growing in office in all sorts of ways. A great, it's part of the myth, but I think it's true too. An extraordinary humanist and a humanity about him that would have been interesting to have seen how it would have played out. Particularly in some conflicting, I think, values that would have come into play.
We are due to pause once again for the usual reasons, but before we do, it is also time to invite telephone calls. The lines are open at this instant, and the number, of course, is 591-7200, 591-7200. If you're listening to us on the Internet at some greater distance and would rather get through by email, that is fully available. and the email address is extension720@tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word, at Tribune, T-R-I-B-U-N-E, .com, or 591-7200. We'll be right back and on to those calls and emails after these words, with a quick reintroduction of our guests and then directly to the phones and to the email. Those guests are, to begin with, James L. Swanson, whose new book, Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer, gave us the occasion, in fact, for this program. Ordinarily, James Swanson is resident in Washington, where he is these days at which? You used to be at Cato, now you're at
the Heritage Foundation and the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies.
One might well note that you are also, of course, a graduate of the University of Chicago, where you studied with a great historian.
John Hope Franklin.
To our other two guests.
My dissertation advisor.
And known to me when he when he was a colleague at the University of Chicago and a rather frequent guest on this program back in the days before he left Chicago for what university?
Duke.
Right.
He's, as I said, Lincoln was my hero. John Hope Franklin is my current hero.
Yeah. Vernon Burton is with us, professor of history and sociology at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Michael Perman, who is professor of history at the other University of Illinois, here in Chicago. 591-7200, and gentlemen, here is the first caller. Good evening.
Hi. I was just curious to see what your guests thought of the of those that claim, Booth survived a tobacco barn fire and was actually replaced by a double therein.
My goodness, that's a very common sort of mythic form that happens after almost any significant historical figure is killed, isn't it?
Yes. No, John Wilkes Booth was not an Elvis. He did not live on. That rumor did spread pretty quickly, though. But all the evidence proves conclusively that it was John Wilkes Booth who was shot at the Garrett Farm that night. Of course, that didn't stop not one, but several men from claiming to be Booth imposters. One claimed to live in Texas, another in Oklahoma. A lawyer surfaced who claimed that he represented John Wilkes Booth and had him as a client in the 1880s. A crazed woman surfaced in 1937 saying that she was the illegitimate granddaughter of the Booth that survived. It's great storytelling and great myth-making, but it's not true.
What sort of career did his brother Edwin have after the war?
Well,
he still remained a popular figure in American theater, didn't he?
Well, when Edwin heard the news that his brother had shot Lincoln, he was devastated. And he issued a moving letter to the American people, sympathizing with their grief and announcing that he would leave the stage. He thought he would leave the stage forever.
Yeah.
No one suspected Edwin. No one held it against him because they knew what a strong Union man he was. But the people demanded that he come back. And less than a year later, in January 1866, Harper's Weekly, the Life magazine of the time, did a full-page, front-page woodcut of Edwin Booth welcoming him back to the American stage. Of course, Edwin couldn't bring himself to hate his brother, but he did hate the crime. And for the rest of his life, Edwin did keep a large photograph of John Wilkes at his bedside. But the American people demanded that he come back to the stage, and he went on to have one of the great careers in American theater.
Also largely a Shakespearean actor.
Yes, exactly.
Back to the phones, 591-7200, and you are next on the air. Good evening.
Thank you, sir, very much. I'm from Texas, and I found this discussion very painful, even though I know Texas is not the Deep South. I think the Civil War was so futile, but it seems to me even if the South had won, for economic reasons, the two countries, if I can call them two countries, would have become one sometime in the 20th century, because they were just so economically tied to one another. Do you think, I want to know if your guests think that the two nations, if only for economic reasons, would have gotten back together, thereby underscoring the futility of the Civil War in the first place?
Yes, a very valuable question, gentlemen.
Never thought of that, I must say. I suppose that if the South had managed to keep its independence, there would have had to have been diplomatic relations. They were separate countries. There would have been probably, since they had common borders, there would have been contacts, obviously. I don't know that they would have gotten back together, because then the whole point of the South leaving was to be separate from the United States, even though there were things that they did value and like about the United States. And so I find that difficult to imagine, frankly, but maybe other people would have a different view.
I just want to mention something else. I was raised to revere Robert E. Lee, and I happen to think he was the second greatest American that ever lived after George Washington. But in the 30 years I've lived out here in Illinois, I've come to an appreciation of Abraham Lincoln. And I read the Doris Kearns Goodwin's book about his cabinet recently and really came to respect Lincoln all the more for reading her book.
We thank you, sir, for the call.
You're welcome.
And we'll go directly to another. On 591-7200, you are on the air. Good evening.
Hi there.
Yes, sir.
My question was, how widespread was sentiment in the North for just letting the South go?
Mm-hmm. An interesting question.
Well, a number of people said, let them go and let the slaves take care of them. Wayward sisters departing priests was what Horace Greeley said. There is an interesting question, actually. The South, they were there, they wanted something, and people would have fought for that. But in the North, they could have got along fine without the South, actually. They would have taken a little bit of a hit economically, but the North would have survived without the South. So the question is then, what drove Northerners to go down South and to get back this part of the country, which a lot of them didn't like very much? That is another question, and I think there are all sorts of ways of looking at it, but it's not as self-evident that, of course, the North had to fight to get the South back. There's a good reason to not do that.
I think it was divided, but I also think that Lincoln articulated so well the idea that liberty was tied up with this Union, and once you started letting one part go, where would it end? And this commitment, as he saw it earlier, to the Constitution and holding the Union together, and then as it transfers into this war for emancipation and freedom later, sort of takes on another meaning. But it was divided. What is amazing is how Lincoln articulated so well, I think, the meaning of Union for people and fighting for Union.
Well, that's why he advised the South. There's no point in having this war. His 1861 inaugural address was really a plea to the South. He told them, I'm not going to do anything about slavery. I don't have that power in the Constitution. But one of his most profound insights, and it was a great metaphor, he said, a man and woman may get divorced and go out of the presence of each other. But if we divorce, we cannot go out of the presence of each other. We will always be together. Our borders will face each other. Our commerce will intersect. And so Lincoln believed strongly that secession was pointless because the North and South couldn't go away from each other.
Our thanks to the caller. Gentlemen, here's an interesting email. One of the articles of the Constitution of the Confederacy stipulated that no state would have the right to secede from the Confederacy. There was no similar stipulation in the Constitution on which it was patterned, or was there?
No. South put it in writing, but no country will provide for its own constitution for its own dissolution, and the South only did it because they didn't want South Carolina to do to the Confederacy what the Confederacy was doing to the United States.
This listener goes on to ask specifically, is Jefferson Davis on record as having opposed this article in the Confederacy's Constitution?
I don't know.
I should think he might have opposed it, if he wants to hold this new nation together.
Yes, except that they believed in the right of secession under the Union, and therefore it would have been difficult not to put it in. But on the other hand, the Confederacy, for example, did not reopen the slave trade, which they could have done. They also kept the three-fifths clause with a close vote. Some people wanted to get rid of it so that then...
Make clear what the three-fifths clause was.
The three-fifths clause has to do with representation in the Congress, that slaves actually, would be included at a rate of three-fifths instead of one whole person.
No, they would not have the right to vote.
No, they would not be.
But they would be represented.
Well, they would not be, but there would be more people for Virginia or for slaveholders. So they kept that, as opposed to making it a whole, five-fifths.
Sure. So. The peculiar institution requires some pretty peculiar jurisprudential arrangements.
Yes.
We pause a quick round of commercials, then directly back to the team of Swanson, Burton, and Perman. It's not a law firm. And on to your call, to more of your calls on 591-7200. Here is an email from a listener who regularly lives in Atlanta, Georgia, but apparently he says, listening to you this week in Las Vegas. But he's an internet listener, obviously, and he asks quite simply, why was secession deemed illegal? Isn't the Constitution silent on the matter?
Yes, the Constitution is silent. As I said, no Constitution will provide for its own dissolution, except the Confederate one. but it was illegal because it was dissolving the sort of the relationship. I mean, then it was. Well, I don't know quite. You're the lawyer.
Well, I mean, the counter argument is, the states or the colonies individually preceded the Confederation. The Articles of Confederation preceded the Constitution, and of course, the Confederate argument was twofold. One, Jeffersonian, the Jeffersonian right of revolution. When a government fails to do certain things, the people have a right to rise up and leave it or reform it or have a rebellion or a revolution. And secondly, their argument was, since the compact was voluntarily entered into by the states could, if they so chose, withdraw from the compact if their rights were being abused or ignored or violated.
Yeah, except that those are rationalizations.
Right.
They are actually
right.
doing something. They claim the right of secession, but there's no right actually that is there to claim. They think it's, for the same reason you mentioned, it's a right because of those things, but it's not a legal right.
Right, exactly.
And to leave the country is to commit treason, of course. So that's what's the problem.
And with that gentleman back to the phones, 591-7200, you are on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, how you doing?
Fine, sir. Go ahead.
Great show. The courts in the Confederation government, was there a Supreme Court? Did they have 9 judges? Was there any cases heard? And have you ever heard any judges jump from the South going to the North and North going to the South after the Civil War started?
Well, the Confederate Constitution does have a judicial clause in it. But there's nothing very specific about the nature of that court. There are, of course, courts in the South, but a Supreme Court for the Confederacy actually was never set up. And so these were handled by lower courts, but no kind of court which would decide on constitutionality and judicial review and differences between the states. That didn't come up until very late, and they never actually established the institution of a Supreme Court.
State courts really governed most of the Confederacy.
Yeah. Our thanks to that caller, and let's go to this one. On 591-7200. Good evening.
Hi there. I'm interested in women, especially in the Confederacy. There's an author, Harnett Kane, who's written a series of novels. I recently finished The Gallant Mrs. Stonewall, and I also read The Smiling Rebel, which I think is based on Belle Boyd. But I'm wondering how much truth is in those novels, if they are familiar with her work.
Are these novels that date back to the Civil War or written later?
They were written in the 20s and 30s, and I believe Harnett Kane was from Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can talk about the women in two ways, as part of the conspiracy and Booth and the assassination, but also the Confederacy in general. Women were revered in the South, sometimes kept in gilded cages, but nonetheless, women did a lot to help run the plantations and run the businesses of the South. Often they don't get credit for what they did, but during the war, women were considered essential to the Confederate war effort as nurses, makers of flags, makers of bandages, collecting donations for the troops, and as secret agents. There were many Confederate women who operated in Washington, D.C., and also elsewhere working for the South. There were the mysterious Branson sisters in Baltimore. There was Mary Surratt, who was involved in Booth's plot to kidnap the president. the mysterious Sarah Slater, another Confederate agent, or a woman named Mrs. Quisenberry, who helped Booth escape, and she was a longtime Confederate agent throughout the war. We don't know everything about the Confederate women agents, because much of what they did was secret, but the role of women in the South is fascinating.
Okay, well, I'm from a little town in Mississippi where Grant had his headquarters, and he left his wife there ill, so that's why they didn't burn the town. So I'm real interested just in general in the women. And
I just want to add, I think rather than reading novels, there are a lot of history books written by historians on women in the Confederacy, and you should go to your library or on the internet and find some of them, because I think novels are problematic because they are not necessarily accurate, and they're imagined rather than...
All the same, ma'am, we thank you for the call.
One of the interesting things about novels, I think they did, at the time, there were at least seven novels written as Confederate novels during the time period, and what they do help do, I think, is create Confederate nationalism as they sort of depict the sort of and say the sort of things that you talk about in your book. They're being said in the novels almost word for word you could take out of your book.
Speaking of Confederate nationalism, is it not the case that it still persists all these years later? What exactly is the League of the South, and what are they after?
Well, they have a website. You can go and look at it. But it is a group which pretty much claims the right of secession and is arguing for secession still today. There are various groups. I mean, they're
some of these are university intellectuals, are they not?
Well, I think it was founded by, or at least one of the people was a graduate student or got his PhD at the University of Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
I remember. But yes, there have been a number who have been university professors.
McWinney and...
Yes, I don't know if Grady was a member or not.
Is there still in the South, quite apart from those who actually contemplate seceding again, is there still strong anti-Union sentiment and strong Confederate nostalgia?
Well, I met some of those people while I was writing the book. I have an acquaintance whose family, she revealed to me, has celebrated their family cotillion on April 15th. Beginning in 1866,
the
first year anniversary of Lincoln's death.
Yeah.
There was certainly a cult of Booth that began right after the assassination. The code name for Booth among Booth devotees in the South was Our Brutus. In New Orleans, they printed sheet music with Booth on the cover and did an Our Brutus song. And at the time Lincoln was murdered, many in the South rejoiced. Not many were willing to reveal it because they feared Union punishment. But I've met many Southerners who still resent Lincoln, whose families personally suffered. Some friends have told me that their families didn't recover from the Civil War for 80 or 90 years. And there is still some strong resentment against the Union and against Lincoln.
I think an interesting thing historically is the memory, and I think we all have to be careful. If every single plantation that Southern whites claim was burned, and all the, literally, if you think about this, you know, it's no wonder the old debate about could the South have been economically viable. You'd have to have the entire force of enslaved people spending their time whitewashing these columns. I mean, it's a creation, I think, to a certain extent. It's interesting. It's probably less Union than the, it's an international thing, the reverence of the Confederate soldier, I think, which is somewhat different than nationalism, but it's gotten mixed up in many ways over time.
We pause once again for a last round of commercials, then right back to the phones, 591-7200. Our guests tonight have been and continue for the next 10 minutes to be Michael Perman, Professor of History at the University of Illinois, Chicago, Vernon Burton, Professor of History at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and James L. Swanson, author of Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase to Catch Lincoln's Killer. That's just published by HarperCollins. And you're doing a book signing, are you, tomorrow?
Yes, I am. Tomorrow, Thursday, February 23rd, I'm speaking and signing books at the Newberry Library at 6 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And with that, gentlemen, let us go quickly back to the phones. Here is the next caller. Good evening.
Good evening, Milt. Really fascinating show, and I thank you for it. This is a question I wanted to ask since I was a little kid. If The South had managed to win their struggle. Would it have the territories west of the Mississippi formed, in fact, a third nation on this continent, a United States of the West, so to speak? And had the situation persisted, a north, a south, and a west, how might that have affected the great historical circumstances of the 20th century, such as World War I, the Great Depression, and World War II?
The answer to that is that Northerners may have feared that if the South went, the rest of the country would fall apart and break up. In fact, that didn't happen. So if the North wins, they will have access to those territories, and the South will be encircled, which is the very thing they feared in the first place, and that's why they decided to leave. But they would have been encircled. They couldn't have taken their slaves into those territories. So they would have been Union ones, and they would have been free.
But don't you think they could
have...
If the
South wins, what happens? But what happens if the South wins?
Oh, I'm sorry. Then there would have been a... They could have sent troops in, I guess. An area that they would have contended
as
for.
Somebody said,
or they would, the South would have ignored that and gone south, which is, I think...
Of course, I'm responsible for stirring up all of these counterfactuals, but I'm reminded of that dialogue in which somebody says, if we had some ham, we could have some ham and eggs, if we had some eggs. You go endlessly in all directions once you play this contingency game.
But I think the South had visions of empire, and certainly Cuba, and going south toward Mexico and going west. If they had won, they would have expanded. They saw that as the reason, or at least that was one of the articulated reasons of why they were willing to go to war and succeed, as they had to continue to expand.
Is it true, as one sees in some Hollywood films, at least one that I remember, that some Confederate troops cross over into Mexico and try to set up some sort of sovereignty there?
You do have that happening, and some of the films have portrayed sort of versions of that happening.
Yeah.
Some go to Brazil, in fact, and try to reform the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm. And so there's a Confederate settlement?
In Brazil.
Oh, in Brazil.
Is it still there? Rosalind Carter's great uncle, I think, was one of those who had gone to Brazil.
Now that's interesting. Didn't know that. Here's a listener in Rochester, New York, who emails the following. The South was going to lose the war once in 1862 General Polk violated Kentucky's neutrality. The North was then able to make its way into Tennessee and use the river systems to its advantage. True? Was that a crucial turn of fate in 1862?
This is Leonidas Polk, and what happened?
He violates Kentucky's neutrality. So asserts this listener in Rochester.
Well, I think that the North had to move through Tennessee. Don't think they had to go through Kentucky to get down into the South and try and make contact with the Mississippi River and go down over the Ohio. So I think they would have. I don't think they had to go through Tennessee, Kentucky, though, in fact, they did. So I don't think it was that critical.
One of the most interesting things, though, is Lincoln's reputedly just said, you know, I want God on my side, but I got to have Kentucky. And this we were talking about earlier about Confederate memory and Confederate nationalism today. Kentucky identifies itself so strongly with the Confederacy, but it had so many more troops that fought for the Union than it ever did for the Confederacy.
We go back to the phones on 591-7200. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to know why President Johnson didn't pardon Mary Surratt from hanging.
We better review who Mary Surratt was.
Mary Surratt was ran a boarding house at which in Washington, at which many of the conspirators had met and gone through, and so she became caught up in the conspiracy on the assumption that she had to have known what was going on. She couldn't have just been in that small house and not known it, but James Swanson could answer this better than I can, but she got caught up in it, but there was no real sort of evidence that she was actually in on the conspiracy in any concrete way.
Well, I think the caller was asking about the controversy of what happened after she was condemned to death by the military tribunal. The same judges who condemned her to death signed a clemency petition recommending to President Johnson that she be spared the death penalty. There was confusion. Johnson claimed he was never shown that petition. The judge advocate general swore he did show it to Johnson, but he probably wouldn't have pardoned her anyway. Mrs. Stephen A. Douglas tried to get the pardon. Mary Surratt's daughter begged to see him. He refused to see her. Johnson said Mary Surratt kept the nest that hatched the egg of the plot to assassinate Lincoln. And I don't think he would have pardoned her whether he got that petition or not.
What is the roster of the fate of all those other co-conspirators?
Well, eight were put on trial for their lives afterwards. Mary Surratt, who kept the boarding house, Lewis Powell, who stabbed the Secretary of State, George Atzerodt, who failed to kill the Vice President David Harold. Those four were hanged in July 1865. Four, including Dr. Mudd, were sentenced to life in prison. Later, the survivors were pardoned by President Johnson. Of course, there were many more. Lewis Powell, the attacker of Secretary of State Seward, said to a military officer, "You haven't caught the half of us."
You think that's true?
It's true. Many people, the majority of people who helped Booth were not put on trial, and we know that there are others who helped him whose names we've never learned. I've tried to identify some of them in my book, and I've told their stories, but they're ones that I don't know about, that no one knows about.
A question to three historians. What are the best available histories of the war and of the great clash between these two sectors of American civilization? I don't mean the high scholarly work, but the work intended for general readership.
It's both available to the general reader and also, I think, for the scholarly community. I'd have to go with James McPherson's Still, Battle Cry of Freedom. Because he was one of my thesis advisors, but I think that is an extraordinarily well-done book that can be read at different levels.
I would agree. It is an academic book, but it is very readable and very accessible. It's quite long, of course, but it is a book that anybody who's interested in this would get a lot out of. And
we did a program with McPherson, and I believe it's on our audio archive way back, but it's still there, available for listening once again, if you could find it, by scrolling down on the long roster of programs.
Two of my favorite books are a little older. The McPherson one is wonderful. I like Margaret Leach's Reveille in Washington from the 1940s. It tells everything about the culture of the wartime capital, and from that book, you learn so much about the Civil War. I still think Carl Sandburg is worth reading. Professional historians have turned against Sandburg, but he tells the story in an almost Homeric way. Great passion, great intensity. He creates the mood of the nation during the Civil War, his six-volume Lincoln biography.
But it is an apotheosis, or apotheosis, if you pronounce it that way, of Lincoln. And it gave us really a variant on the Lincoln legend, which persisted for a long time.
Lincoln was the sort of the plain folk sort of type, man of the countryside, and a simple man, that kind of Lincoln.
And ironically, Sandburg leaves Illinois and lives in North Carolina.
Yeah. Gentlemen, time has elapsed, I fear. Thank you so much for joining us.